what is often considered the most...
Hi, my name is Eddie. I'm here in Catskill.
Community Center.
Come on to the Community Center.
You're listening to...
WGXC.
90.7.
FM.
ACRA.
ACRA.
Let's listen to that and see how...
Lucy Lyon, the King of Beasts.
Music from elsewhere and beyond.
Huge elephant trumpet across the plains.
Imaginary soundtracks to unmade foreign films.
And there are rhino, those craggy creatures surviving from a bygone age.
Snack Point Charlie. Hosted by Jeff Economy. Every first Wednesday from 10 p.m. to midnight on WGXC 90.7 FM, WGXC.org.
WGXC underwriting support is provided in part by Crisafulli Brothers Plumbing, Heating, Cooling, and Electrical, Upstate New York's home services company since 1993. Red Carpet Service and Solutions. For more information, visit CRISBRO.com.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support.
Let me clear my throat. Ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, friends, and enemies, welcome back to another edition of Goodnight Norman with me, your host, Norman Douglas, broadcasting to you live from beautiful downtown Hudson, on radio station WGXC 90.7 FM in the Columbia and Greene counties of New York State and WGXC.org. On that technological miracle, the World Wide Web. Tonight, more fiction in this fictional reality. It's called, I'm going to start off with a story called Black Man. I'm going to start off by clearing my throat again. Pardon me. It's called Black Man and White Woman in Dark Green Rowboat. Written by Russell Banks and collected in The Angel on the Roof, the stories of Russell Banks. Black Man and White Woman in Dark Green Rowboat. It was the third day of an August heat wave. Within an hour of the sun's rising above the spruce and pine trees that grew along the eastern hills, a blue-gray haze had settled over the lake and trailer park, so that from the short, sandy spit that served as a swimming place for the residents of the trailer park, you couldn't see the far shore of the lake. Around 7, a man in plaid bathing trunks and white bathing cap, in his 60s, but still straight and apparently in good physical condition, left one of the trailers and walked along the paved lane to the beach. He draped his white towel over the bow of a flaking bottle green rowboat that had been dragged onto the sand and walked directly into the water, and when the water was up to his waist, he began to swim, smoothly, slowly, straight out in the still water for 200 yards or so, where he turned, treaded water for a few moments, and then started swimming back toward shore. When he reached the shore, he dried himself and walked back to his trailer and went inside. By the time he closed the door, the water was smooth again, a dark green plain beneath the thick gray-blue sky. No birds moved or sang. Even the insects were silent. In the next few hours, people left their trailers to go to their jobs in town. Those who had jobs, the nurse, the bank teller, the carpenter, the woman who worked in the office at the tannery, and her little girl, who would spend the day with a babysitter in town. They moved slowly, heavily, as if with regret, even the child. Time passed, and the trailer park was silent again, while the sun baked the metal roofs and sides of the trailers, heating them up inside so that by mid-morning it was cooler outside than in, and the people came out and tried to find a shady place to sit. First to appear was a middle-aged woman in large sunglasses and white shorts and halter, her head hidden by a floppy, wide-brimmed cloth hat. She carried a book and sat on the shaded side of her trailer in an aluminum and plastic webbing lawn chair and began to read her book. Then from his trailer came the man in the plaid bathing trunks, bareheaded now and shirtless and tanned to a chestnut color, his skin the texture of old leather. He wore rubber sandals and proceeded to hook up a garden hose and water the small, meticulously weeded vegetable garden on the slope behind his trailer. Every now and then he aimed the hose down and sprayed his bony feet. From the first trailer in from the road, where a sign that said manager had been attached over the door, a tall, thick-bodied woman in her 40s with cropped, graying hair, wearing faded jeans cut off at mid-thigh and a floppy T-shirt that had turned pink in the wash, walked slowly out to the main road, a half mile, to get her mail. When she returned, she sat on her steps and read the letters and advertisements and the newspaper. About that time, a blonde boy in his late teens with shoulder-length hair, skinny, tanned, shirtless, and barefoot in jeans, emerged from his trailer, sighed, and sat down on the stoop and smoked a joint. At the last trailer in the park, the one next to the beach, an old man smoking a cob pipe and wearing a sleeveless undershirt and beltless khaki trousers, slowly scraped paint from the bottom of an overturned rowboat. He ceased working and watched carefully as, walking slowly past him toward a dark green rowboat on the sand, there came a young black man with a fishing rod in one hand and a tackle box in the other. The man was tall, and though slender, muscular. He wore jeans and a pale blue unbuttoned short-sleeved shirt. The old man said it was too hot for fishing. They wouldn't feed in this weather. And the young man said he didn't care. It had to be cooler on the lake than here on shore. The old man agreed with that. But why bother carrying your fishing rod and tackle box with you when you don't expect to catch any fish? Right, the young man said, smiling. Good question. Placing his box and the rod into the rowboat, he turned to wait for the young woman who was stepping away from the trailer where earlier the middle-aged woman in shorts, halter, and floppy hat had come out and sat in the lawn chair to read. The young woman was a girl, actually 20 or maybe 21. She wore a lime-green terry-cloth bikini and carried a large yellow towel in one hand and a fashion magazine and small brown bottle of tanning lotion in the other. Her long, honey blonde hair swung from side to side across her tanned shoulders as she walked down the lane to the beach, where both the young man and the old man watched her approach. She made a brief remark about the heat to the old man, said good morning to the young man, placed her towel, magazine, and tanning lotion into the dark green rowboat, and helped the young man shove the boat off the hot sand into the water. Then she jumped into the boat and sat herself in the stern, and the man, barefoot, with the bottoms of his jeans rolled to his knees, waded out, got into the boat, and began to row. For a while, as the man rowed and the girl rubbed tanning lotion slowly over her arms and legs and across her shoulders and belly, they said nothing. The man pulled smoothly on the oars and watched the girl, and she examined her light brown skin and stroked it and rubbed the oily, sweet-smelling fluid onto it. After a few moments, holding to the gunwales with her hands so that her entire body got exposed to the powerful sun, she leaned back, closed her eyes, and stretched her legs toward the man, placing her small white feet over his large, dark feet. The man studied the wedge of her crotch, then her navel, where a puddle of sweat was collecting, then the rise of her small breasts, and finally her long throat, glistening in the sunlight. The man was sweating from the effort of rowing, and he said he should have brought a hat. He stopped rowing, let the blades of the oars float in the water, and removed his shirt and wrapped it around his head like a turban. The girl, realizing that he had ceased rowing, looked up and smiled at him. "You look like an Arab, a sheikh." "A galley slave, more likely." "No, really, honestly." She lay her head back again and closed her eyes, and the man took up the oars and resumed rowing. They were a long ways out now, perhaps a half mile from the trailer park. The trailers looked like pastel-colored shoeboxes from here, six of them lined up on one side of the lane, six on the other, with a cleared bit of low ground and marsh off to one side, and the outlet of the lake, the Catamount River it was called, on the other. The water was deep there, and below the surface and buried in the mud were blocks of stone and wooden lattices, the remains of fishing weirs the Indians constructed here and used for centuries until the arrival of the Europeans. In the fall, when the lake was low, you could see the tops of the huge boulders the Indians placed into the stream to make channels for their nets and traps. There were weirs like this all over northern New England, most of them considerably more elaborate than this, so no one here paid much attention to these, except perhaps to mention the fact of their existence to a visitor from Massachusetts or New York. It gave the place a history and a certain significance when outsiders were present that it did not otherwise seem to have. The girl lifted her feet away from the man's feet, drawing them back so that her knees pointed straight at his. She turned slightly to one side and stroked her cheekbone and lower jaw with the fingertips and thumb of one hand, leaning her weight on the other forearm and hand. "I'm already putting on weight," she said. "It doesn't work that way. You're just eating too much." "I told Mother." The man stopped rowing and looked at her. "I told Mother," she repeated. Her eyes were closed and her face was directed toward the sun, and she continued to stroke her cheekbone and lower jaw. "When?" "Last night." "And?" "And nothing. I told her that I love you very much." "That's all?" "No, I told her everything." He started rowing again, faster this time and not as smoothly as before. They were nearing a small tree-covered island. Large, rounded rocks lay around the island, half submerged in the shallow water like the backs of huge, coal-colored hippos. The man peered over his shoulder and observed the distance to the island, then drew in the oars and lifted a broken chunk of cinder block tied to a length of clothesline rope and slid it into the water. The rope went out swiftly and cleanly as the anchor sank and then suddenly stopped. The man opened his tackle box and started poking through it, searching for a deep-water spinner. The girl was sitting up now, studying the island with her head canted to one side, as if planning a photograph. Actually, Mother was a lot better than I had expected her to be. If Daddy were alive, it would be different, she said. Daddy hated niggers. Jesus Christ! And Mother loves him. He located the spinner and attached it to the line. My mother likes you. She's a decent woman, and she's tired and lonely, and she's not your enemy any more than I am. You're sure of that? He made a long cast and dropped the spinner between two large rocks and started winding it back in. No, I know your mom is okay. I'm sorry. Tell me what she said. She thought it was great. She likes you. I'm happy, and that's what is really important to her. And she likes you. She worries about me a lot, you know. She's afraid for me. She thinks I'm fragile, especially now, because I've had some close calls. At least, that's how she sees them. Sees what? Oh, you know, depression. Yeah. He cast again, slightly to the left of where he'd put the spinner for the first time. Listen, I don't know how to tell you this, but I might as well come right out and say it. I'm going to do it. This afternoon. Mother's coming with me. She called and set it up this morning. He kept reeling in the spinner, slowly, steadily, as if he hadn't heard her, until the spinner clunked against the side of the boat and he lifted it, dripping from the water. And he said, I hate this whole thing. Hate. Just know that much, will you? She reached out and placed a hand on his arm. I know you do. So do I. But it'll be all right again afterwards, I promise. It'll be just like it was. You can't promise that. No one can. It won't be all right afterwards. It'll be lousy. I suppose you'd rather I just did nothing. Yeah, that's right. Well, we've been through all this before, 100 times. She sat up straight and peered back at the trailer park in the distance. How long do you plan to fish? 1 hour or so. Why? If you want to swim, I'll row you around to the other side of the island and drop you and come back and get you later. No, that's all right. There are too many rocks anyhow. I'll go in when we get back to the beach. I have to be ready to go by 3:30. Yeah, I'll make sure you get there on time, he said, and he made a long cast off to his right in deeper water. I love to sweat, she said, lying back and showing herself once again to the full sun. I love to just lie back and sweat. The man fished and the girl sunbathed. The water was as slick as oil, the air thick and still. After a while, the man reeled in his line and removed the silvery spinner and went back to poking through his tackle box. Where the hell is that damn plug? He mumbled. The girl sat up and watched him, his long, dark back twisted toward her, the vanilla bottoms of his feet, the fluttering muscles of his shoulders and arms, when suddenly he yelped and yanked his hand free of the box and put the meat of his hand directly into his mouth. He looked up at the girl in rage. What, are you all right? She slid back in her seat and drew her legs up close to her and wrapped her arms around her knees. In silence, still sucking on his hand, he reached with the other hand into the tackle box and came back with a pale green and scarlet plug with 6 double hooks attached to the sides and tail. He held it as if by the head. Delicately, he held it as if by the head, delicately with thumb and forefinger, and showed it to her. The girl grimaced. Ah, you poor thing. He took his hand from his mouth and clipped the plug to his line and cast it toward the island, dropping it about 20 feet from the rocky shore, a short ways to the right of a pair of dog-sized boulders. The girl picked up her magazine and began to leaf through the pages, stopping every now and then to examine an advertisement or photograph. Again and again, the man cast the flashing plug into the water and drew it back to the boat, twitching its path from side to side to imitate the motions of an injured, fleeing, pale-colored animal. Finally, lifting the plug from the water next to the boat, the man said, "Let's go." Old Merle was right. Ain't no sense fishing when the fish ain't feeding. The whole point is catching fish, right? He said. And he removed the plug from the line and tossed it into his open tackle box. I suppose so. I don't like fishing anyhow. Then, after a few seconds, as if she were pondering the subject, but I guess it's relaxing, even if you don't catch anything. The man drew up the anchor, pulling in the wet rope hand over hand, and finally he pulled the cinder block free of the water and set it dripping behind him in the bow of the boat. They had drifted closer to the island now and were in the cooling shade of the thicket of oaks and birches that crowded together over the island. The water turned suddenly shallow here, only a few feet deep, and they could see the rocky bottom clearly. "Be careful," the girl said. "We'll run aground in a minute." She watched the bottom nervously. The man looked over her head and beyond, all the way to the shore and the trailer park. The shapes of the trailers were blurred together in the distance so that you could not tell where one trailer left off and another began. "I wish I could just leave you here," the man said, still not looking at her. "What?" The boat drifted silently in the smooth water between a pair of large rocks, barely disturbing the surface. The man's dark face was somber and ancient beneath the turban that covered his head and the back of his neck. He leaned forward on his seat, his forearms resting wearily on his thighs, his large hands hanging limply between his knees. "I said, I wish I could just leave you here," he said in a soft voice, and he looked down at his hands. She looked nervously around, as if for an ally or witness. "We have to go back."
"You mean you have to go back?"
"That's right," she said. He slipped the oars into the oarlocks and started rowing, turning the boat and shoving it quickly away from the island. Facing the trailer park, he rowed along the side of the island, then around behind it, out of sight of the trailer park and the people who lived there, emerging again in a few moments on the far side of the island, rowing steadily, smoothly, powerfully. Now his back was to the trailer park, and the girl was facing it, looking grimly past the man toward the shore. He rowed, and they said nothing more. In a while, they had returned to shore and life among the people who lived there. A few of them were in the water and on the beach when the dark green rowboat touched land and the black man stepped out and drew the boat onto the sand. The old man in the white bathing cap was standing in waist-deep water, and the woman who was the manager of the trailer park stood near the edge of the water, cooling her feet and ankles. The old man with the cob pipe was still chipping at the bottom of his rowboat, and next to him, watching and idly chatting, stood the kid with the long blonde hair. They all watched silently as the black man turned away from the dark green rowboat and carried his fishing rod and tackle box away. And then they watched the girl, carrying her yellow towel, magazine, and bottle of tanning lotion, step carefully out of the boat and walk to where she lived with her mother. Black Man and White Woman in Dark Green Rowboat by Russell Banks. Listening to me, your host, Norman Douglas. This is Good Night, Norman. Coming to you live and in the strange harmonic geometry that is sound. From beautiful downtown Hudson, New York, just across the river from the studios of radio station WGXC 90.7 FM in Columbia and Greene counties upstate New York, and WGXC.org on the miracle of the interweb. What's the date? I guess it's the 19th of June. Am I wrong? Maybe I am.
Nope, I'm wrong. Damn it. It's the 17th. I don't have anything to say about that. Not that I had anything to say about 19th. Okay, this is a song. This is not a song, but it could be, maybe. Should I sing it? No. It's called... I'm trying to decide here what I'm going to read next. I know I should have decided this before, but I'm all like... It's between Zora Neale Hurston and Lydia Cabrera. Lydia Cabrera translated some Afro-Cuban tales almost 100 years ago, maybe about 100 years ago. And around the same time, Zora Neale Hurston was doing her thing. Okay, I'm going to go for the Zora Neale Hurston. The name of this story is John Redding Goes to Sea. It's from a collection of stories from the Harlem Renaissance, all of them by Zora Neale Hurston, called Hitting a Straight Lick with a Crooked Stick. And the name of the story, John Redding Goes to Sea. By Zora Neale Hurston. The villagers said that John Redding was a queer child. His mother thought he was too. She would shake her head sadly and observe to John's father, "Alf, it's too bad our boy got a spell on him." Father always met this lament with indifference, if not impatience. "Oh, woman, stop that talk about conjure. Tain't so nohow. I don't want John to get that foolishness in him. Case you always tries to know more than me. Of course, you always tries to know more than me, but I ain't so ignorant. I knows he myself. Many and many's the people been drove out of their senses by conjuration, or rid to death by witches. I keep on telling you, woman, it ain't so. Believe it all you wants to, but don't you tell my son none of it." Perhaps 10-year-old John was puzzling to the simple folk there in the Florida woods, for he was an imaginative child and fond of daydreams. The St. John River flowed a scarce 300 feet from his back door. On its banks at this point grew numerous palms, luxuriant magnolias and bay trees with a dense undergrowth of ferns, cattails, and rope grass. On the bosom of the stream float millions of delicately colored hyacinths. The little brown boy loved to wander down to the water's edge and cast in dry twigs and watch them sail away downstream to Jacksonville, the sea, and the wide world. And John Redding wanted to follow them. Sometimes in his dreams he was a prince, riding away in a gorgeous carriage. Often he was a knight, bestride a fiery charger, prancing down the white shell road that led to distant lands. At other times he was a steamboat captain, piloting his craft down the St. John River to where the sky seemed to touch the water. No matter what he dreamed or whom he fancied himself to be, he always ended by riding away to the horizon, for in his childish ignorance he thought this to be the farthest land. But these twigs, which John called his ships, did not always sail away. Sometimes they would be swept in among the weeds growing in the shallow water and be held there. One day his father came upon him scolding the weeds for stopping his sea-going vessels. "Let go my ships, you old mean weeds, you!" John screamed and stamped impotently. They wants to go away. You let them go on.
Alfred laid his hand on his son's head lovingly. What's the matter, son?
My ships, Pa,
the child answered, weeping. I throwed them in to go way off, and them old weeds won't let them.
Well, don't cry. I thought you was a grown-up man. Men don't cry like babies. You mustn't take it too hard about your ships. You got to get used to things getting tied up. There's lots of folks that go on off too, if something didn't catch them and hold them.
Alfred Redding's brown face grew wistful for a moment, and the child, noticing it, asked quickly,
"Do weeds tangle up folks too, Papa?"
Nah, child, don't be taking too much stock of what I say. I talk some parables sometime. Come on, let's go on to supper.
Alf took his son's hand and started slowly toward the house. Soon John broke the silence.
Pa, when I gets as big as you, I'm going farther than them ships. I'm going to where the sky touched the ground.
Well, son, when I was a boy, I said I was going too. But here I am. I hopes you had better luck than I had.
Pa, I bet you I seen something in the wood that you ain't seen.
What?
See that tallest pine tree over there? How it looked like a skull with a crown on it?
Yes, indeed, said the father, looking toward the tree designated. It do look like a skull since you called my attention to it. You imagine lots of things nobody ever did, son.
Sometime, Pa, that old tree waves to me just after the sun goes down and it makes me sad and scared, too.
I expect you're scared of the dark, that's all, sonny. When you gets bigger, you won't think of such.
Hand in hand, these two trudged across the plowed land and up to the house, the child dreaming of the days when he should wander to far countries, and the man of the days when he might have, of the days when he might have. And thus they entered the kitchen. Mattie Redding, John's mother, was setting the table for supper. She was a small, wiry woman with large eyes that might have been beautiful when she was young, but too much weeping had left them watery and weak.
Mattie, Alf began as he took his place at the table. Don't you know our boy is different from any other child around here? He allows he's going to sea when he get grown, and I reckon I'll let him.
The woman turned from the stove, skillet in hand.
Alf, you ain't gone crazy, is you? John can't help wanting to stray off because he got a spell on him, but you ought to be ashamed to be encouraging him.
And I done told you 40 times not to talk that low-life mess in front of my boy.
Well, if it ain't no conjure in the world, how come Mitch Potts been laying on his back 6 months and the doctor can't do him no good? Answer me that. Very night John was born, Granny seed old witch Judy Davis creeping out of this yard. You know she has swore to fix me for marrying you away from her daughter, Edna. She put travel dust down for my child. That's what she done to make him walk away from me. And ever since he's been able to crawl, he's been trying to go.
Matty, a man don't need no travel dust to make him want to hit the road. It just comes natural for a man to travel. They all wants to go with some time or other, but they can't all get away. I wants my John to go and see, because I wanted to go myself. When he comes back, I can see them fern places with his eyes. He can't help wanting to go, because he's a man, child.
Miss Redding promptly went off into a fit of weeping, but the man and boy ate supper unmoved. 12 years of married life had taught Alfred that far from being miserable when she wept, his wife was enjoying a bit of self-pity. Thus, John Redding grew to manhood, playing, studying, and dreaming. He attended the village school, as did most of the youth about him, but he also went to high school at the county seat, where none of the villagers went. His father shared his dreams and ambitions, but his mother could not understand why he should wish to go to strange places where neither she nor his father had been. No one of their community had been farther away than Jacksonville. Few indeed had ever even been there. Their own gardens, general store, and occasional trips to the county seat 7 miles away sufficed for all their needs. Life was simple indeed with these folk. John was the subject of much discussion among the country folk. Why didn't he teach school instead of thinking about strange places and people? Did he think himself better than any of the bells thereabout that he would not go according any of them? He must be fixed, as his mother claimed, else where did his queer notions come from? Well, he was always queer, and one could not expect the man to be different from the child. They never failed to stop work at the approach of Alfred in order to be at the fence to inquire after John's health and ask when he expected to leave. Oh, Alfred would answer, yeah, as soon as his ma gets reconciled to the notion. He's a mighty dutiful boy, my John is. He don't want to hurt her feelings. The boy had on several occasions attempted to reconcile his mother to the notion, but found it a difficult task. Mattie always took refuge in self-pity and tears. Her son's desires were incomprehensible to her, that was all. She did not want to hurt him. It was love, mother love, that made her cling so desperately to John. Lord knows, she would sigh, I never was happy and I never expects to be. And from your actions, put in Alfred hotly, you's determined not to be. That's right, Alfred. Go on and abuse me. You always does. I know I'm ignorant and all that, but this my son. I bred and bone him. He can't help from wanting to go roving because travel dust been put down for him. But maybe we can cure him by discouraging the idea. Well, I wants my son to go, and he wants to go too. He's a man now, Mattie, and we must let John hoe his own row. If his traveling don't be for long, he'll come back to us better than when he went off. Anyhow, he'll learn that folks is human all over the world. That's worth a lot to know, and it's worth going a long way to find out. What do you say, son? Mama John began slowly. It hurts me to see you so troubled over me going away, but I feel that I must go. I'm stagnating here. This indolent atmosphere will stifle every bit of ambition that's in me. Let me go, Mama, please. What is there here for me? Give me 2 or 3 years to look around, and I'll be back here with you and Papa, and I'll never leave you again. Mama, please let me go. Now, John, it's better for you to stay here and take over the school. Why won't you marry and settle down? I'm sorry, Mama, that you won't consent. I am going, nevertheless. John, my baby... You wouldn't kill your poor old mama, would you? Come kiss me, son. The boy flung his arms about his mother and held her closely while she sobbed on his breast. To all of her pleas, however, he answered, he must go. I'll stay at home this year, Mama, then I'll go for a while, but it won't be long. I'll come back and make you and Papa so very happy. You agree, Mama dear? I reckon tain't nothing tall for me to do else. Things went on very well around the Redding home for some time. During the day, John helped his father about the farm and read a great deal at night. Then, the unexpected happened. John married Stella Canty, a neighbor's daughter. The courtship was brief but ardent, on John's part at least. He danced with Stella at a candy pulling, walked with her home, and in 3 weeks declared himself. Mrs. Redding declared she was happier than she had ever been in her life. She therefore indulged in a whole afternoon of weeping. John's change was occasioned possibly by the fact that Stella was really beautiful. He was young and red-blooded, and the time was spring. Springtime in Florida is not a matter of peeping violets or bursting buds, merely. It is a riot of color in nature, glistening green leaves, pink, blue, purple, yellow blossoms that fairly stagger the visitor from the north. The miles of hyacinths are like an undulating carpet on the surface of the river, and divide reluctantly when the slow-moving alligators push their way log-like across. The nights are white nights as the moon shines with dazzling splendor, or in the absence of that goddess, the soft darkness creeps down laden with innumerable scents. The heavy fragrance of magnolias mingled with the delicate sweetness of jasmine and wild roses. If time and propinquity conquer John, what then? These forces have overcome older men. The raptures of the first few weeks over, John began to saunter out to the gate to gaze wistfully down the white, dusty road, or to wander again to the river as he had done in childhood. To be sure, he did not send forth twig ships any longer, but his thoughts would, in spite of himself, stray down river to Jacksonville, the sea, the wide world, and poor home-tied John Redding wanted to follow them. He grew silent and pensive. Maddie accounted for this by her ever-ready explanation of conjuration. Alfred said nothing but smoked and puttered about the barn more than ever. Stella accused her husband of indifference and pouting. At last, John decided to bring matters to a head and broach the subject to his wife. "Stella, dear, I want to go roving about the world for a spell. Would you stop here with Papa and Mama and wait for me to come back?"
"John, is you crazy showing up? If you don't want me, say so, and I can go home to my folks."
"Stella, darling, I do want you, but I want to go away, too. I can have both if you'll let me. We'll be so happy when I return."
"Now, John, you can't push me off one side like that. You didn't have to marry me. There's plenty of others that would have been glad enough to get me. You know I want educated beforehand.
Don't make me too conscious of my weakness, Stella. I know I should never have married you with my inclinations, but it's done now. No use to talk about what is past. I love you and I want to keep you, but I can't stifle that longing for the open road, rolling seas, for peoples and countries I've never seen. I'm suffering too, Stella. I'm paying for my rashness in marrying before I was ready. I'm not trying to shirk my duty. You'll be well taken care of in the meanwhile. John, folks always said you was queer, told me not to marry you, but I just loved you so I couldn't help it. Now to think you wants to sneak off and leave me.
But I'm coming back, darling. Listen, Stella."
But the girl would not. Maddie came in, and Stella fell into her arms, weeping. John's mother immediately took up arms against him. The two women carried on such an effective war against him for the next few days that finally Alfred was forced to take his son's part.
"Maddie, let that boy alone, I tell you. If he was a home buddy, he'd be drove away by y'all's racket."
"Well, Alf, that's all we poor women can do. We wants our husbands and our sons. John's got a wife now, and he ain't got no business to be talking about going nowhere. I allowed that Marion Stella was settling."
"Yeah, that's all you women study about, settling some man. You takes all the get up out of him. Just let a fella make a motion like getting somewhere, and some woman will begin to holler, 'Stop there, where's you going? Don't forget you belongs to me.'
My God, Alf, what you reckon Stella's going to do? Let John walk off and leave her?"
"No, get out of her foolishness and go along with him. He'd take her."
"Stella ain't got no call to go crazy because John is. She ain't no woman to be flopping round from place to place like some of these reps following a section gang."
The man turned abruptly from his wife and stood in the kitchen door. A blue haze hung over the river, and Alfred's attention seemed fixed upon this. In reality, his thoughts were turned inward. He was thinking of the numerous occasions upon which he and his son had sat on the fallen log at the edge of the water and talked of John's proposed travels. He had encouraged his son, given him every advantage his poor circumstances would permit. And now, John was home-tied.
The young man suddenly turned the corner of the house and approached his father. Hello, Papa.
Hello,
son. Where's Mama and Stella? The older man merely jerked his thumb toward the interior of the house and once more gazed pensively toward the river. John entered the kitchen and kissed his mother fondly. Great news, Mama. What now? Got a chance to join the Navy, Mama, and go all around the world. Ain't that grand? John, you surely ain't going to leave me and Stella, is you? Yes, I think I am. I know how both of you feel, but I know how I feel also. You preach to me the gospel of self-sacrifice for the happiness of others, but you're unwilling to practice any of it yourself. Stella can stay here. I'm going to support her and spend all the time I can with her. I'm going. That's settled. But I want to go with your blessing. I want to do something worthy of a strong man. I've done nothing so far but look to you and Papa for everything. Let me learn to strive and think. In short, be a man. Now, John, I'll never give my consent. I know you's hard-headed just like your pa, but if you leave this place over my head, I never want you to come back here no more. If I was laid on the cooling board, I don't want you and standing over me, young man. Don't never come near my grave, you ungrateful wretch. Mrs. Redding arose and flung out of the room. For once, she was too incensed to cry. John stood in his tracks, his eyes dilated with terror at his mother's pronouncement. Alfred, too, was moved. Mrs. Redding banged the bedroom door violently and startled John slightly. Alfred took his son's arm, saying softly, "Come on, son, let's go down the river." At the water's edge, they halted for a short space before seating themselves on the log. The sun was setting in a purple cloud. Hundreds of mosquito hawks darted here and there, catching gnats and being themselves caught by the lightning-swift bull bats. John abstractedly snapped in two the stalk of a slender young bamboo. Taking no note of what he was doing, he broke it into short lengths and tossed them singly into the stream. The old man watched him silently for a while, but finally he said, "Oh, yeah, my boy, some ships gets tangled into weeds." "Yeah, Papa, they certainly do. I guess I'm beaten. Might as well surrender." "Never say die. You never can tell what'll happen." "What can happen? I have courage enough to make things happen, but what can I do against Mama? What man wants to go on a long journey with his mother's curses ringing in his ears? She doesn't understand. I'll wait another year, but I am going because I must." Alfred threw an arm around his son's neck and drew him nearer, but he quickly removed it. Both men instantly drew apart, ashamed for having been so demonstrative. The father looked off to the woodlot and asked with a reminiscent smile, "Son, do you remember showing me that tree that looked like a skeleton head?" "Yeah, I do. It's still there. I look at it sometimes when things have become too painful for me at the house, and I run down here to cool off and think." "You always was imagining things, John. Things that nobody else ever thought on." "Oh, yes, I'm a dreamer. I have such wonderfully complete dreams, Papa. They never come true, but even as my dreams fade, I have others." The men arose without more conversation. Possibly they feared to trust themselves to speech. As they walked leisurely toward the house, Alfred remarked the freshness of the breeze. "About time the rain set in." "It's about time the rain set in," at his son. "The year is wearing on." After a gloomy supper, John strolled out into the spacious front yard and seated himself beneath a china berry tree. The breeze had grown a trifle stronger since sunset, and it continued down from the southwest. Maddie and Stella sat on the deep front porch, but Alfred joined John under the tree. The family was divided into two armed camps, and the hostilities had reached the stage where no quarter could be asked or given.
About 9 o'clock, an automobile came flying down the dusty white road and halted at the gate. A white man slammed the gate open and hurried up the walk towards the house, but stopped abruptly before the men under the chinaberry tree. It was Mr. Hill, the builder of the new bridge that spanned the river.
"Howdy, Don. Howdy, Al. I'm mighty glad I found yous. I'm in trouble."
"Well, now, Mr. Hill," answered Alfred slowly but pleasantly, "we's glad you found us, too. What trouble could you be having now?"
"It's the bridge. The Weather Bureau says that the rains will be upon us in 48 hours. If it catches the bridge as it is now, I'm afraid all my work of the past 5 months will be swept away, to say nothing of $500,000 worth of labor and materials. I got all my men at work now, and I thought to get as many extra hands as I could to help out tonight and tomorrow. We can make her weather tight in that time if I can get about 20 more.
"Well, I'll go, Mr. Hill," said John with a great deal of energy. "I don't want Papa out on that bridge. Too dangerous."
"Well, good for you, John," cried the white man. "Now, if I had a few more men of your brawn, I could build an entirely new bridge in 48 hours. Come on and jump in the car. I'm a-taking men down as I find them."
"Wait a minute. I must put on my blue jeans. I won't be long." John arose and strode to the house. He knew his mother and wife had overheard everything, but he paused for a moment to speak to them. "Mama, I'm going to work all night on the bridge." There was no answer. He turned to his wife. "Stella, don't be lonesome. I'll be home at daybreak." His wife was as silent as his mother. John stood for a moment on the steps, then resolutely strode past the women and into the house. A few minutes later, he emerged, clad in his blue jeans and brogans. This time he said nothing to the silent figures rocking back and forth on the porch. But when he was a few feet from the steps, he called back, "Bye, Mama. Bye, Stella," and hurried down the walk to where his father sat. "So long, Papa. I'll be home around 7. Alfred roused himself and stood, placing both hands upon his son's broad shoulders, and said softly, "Be careful, son. Don't fall or nothing." "I will, Papa. Don't you get into quarrel on my account." John hurried on to the waiting car and was whirled away. Alfred sat for a long time beneath the tree where his son had left him and smoked on. The women soon went indoors. On the night breeze were borne the mingled scents of jasmine, of roses, of damp earth, of the river, of the pine forest nearby. A solitary whippoorwill sent forth his plaintive call from the nearby shrubbery. A giant owl hooted and screeched from the woodlot. The calf confined in the barn bleated and was answered by his mother's sympathetic moo from his pen. Around 10 o'clock, the breeze freshened, growing stiffer until midnight, when it became a gale. Alfred festooned the doors and bolted the wooden shutters at the windows. The three persons sat about a round table in the kitchen, upon which stood a bulky kerosene lamp, flickering and sputtering in the wind that came through the numerous cracks in the walls. The wind rushed down the chimney, blowing puffs of ashes about the room. It banged the cooking utensils on the walls. The drinking gourd hanging outside the door played a weird tattoo, hollow and unearthly, against the thin wooden wall. The man and the women sat silently. Even if there had been no storm, they would not have talked. They could not go to bed because the women were afraid to retire during a storm, and the man wished to stay awake and think of his son. Thus they sat, the women hot with resentment toward the man and terrified by the storm, the man hardly mindful of the tempest, but eating his heart out in pity for his boy. Time wore heavily on, and now a new element of terror was added. A screech owl alighted on the roof and shivered forth his doleful cry, possibly been blown out of his nest by the wind. Mattie started up at the sound, but fell back in her chair, pale as death. "My Lord," she gasped, "that's a show sign of death." Stella hurriedly thrust her hand in the salt jar and threw some into the chimney of the lamp. The color of the flame changed from yellow to blue-green, but this burning of the salt did not have the desired effect to drive away the bird from the roof. Mattie slipped out of her blue calico wrapper and turned it wrong side out before replacing it. Even Alfred turned one sock.
"Al," said Mattie, what do you reckon is going to happen from this?"
"How do I know, Mattie?"
"I wish John hadn't went away from here tonight."
"Huh. Outside, the tempest raged. The palms rattled dryly, and the giant pines groaned and sighed in the grip of the wind. Flying leaves and pine mast filled the air. Now and then, a brilliant flash of lightning disclosed a bird being blown here and there with the wind. The prodigious roar of the thunder seemed to rock the earth. Black clouds hung so low that the tops of the pines among them moaned slowly before the wind and made the darkness awful. The screech owl continued his tremulous cry. The wind ceased and the rain commenced. Huge drops clattered down upon the shingle roof like buckshot and ran from the eaves in torrents. It entered the house through the cracks in the walls and under the doors. It was a deluge in volume and force, but subsided before morning. The sun came up brightly on the havoc of the wind and rain, calling forth millions of feathered creatures. The white sand everywhere was full of tiny cups dug out by the force of the falling raindrops. The rims of the little depressions crunched noisily underfoot. At daybreak, Mr. Redding set out for the bridge. He was uneasy. On arriving, he found that the river had risen 12 feet during the cloudburst and was still rising. The slow St. John's was swollen far beyond its banks and rushing on to the sea like a mountain stream, sweeping away houses, great blocks of earth, cattle, trees, in short, anything that came within its grasp. Even the steel framework of the new bridge was gone. The siren of the fiber factory was tied down for half an hour, announcing the disaster to the countryside. When Alfred arrived, he found nearly all the men of the district there. The river, red and swollen, was full of floating debris. Huge trees were swept along as relentlessly as chicken coops and fence rails. Some steel piles were all that was left of the bridge. Damn it. I'm going to try to read 4 pages really fast. Alfred went down a group of men who were fishing members of the ill-fated construction gang out of the water. Many were able to swim ashore unassisted. Wagons backed up and were hurriedly driven away, loaded with wet, shivering men. 2 men had been killed outright. Others seriously wounded. 3 men had been drowned. At last, all had been accounted for except John Redding. His father ran here and there asking for him, calling his name. No one knew where he was. No one remembered seeing him since daybreak. Dozens of women had arrived at the scene of the disaster by this time. Maddie and Stella, wrapped in woolen shawls, were among them. They rushed to Alfred in alarm, asking where was John. "I don't know," answered Alfred impatiently. "That's what I'm trying to find out now." "Do you reckon he's run away?" asked Stella thoughtlessly. Maddie bristled instantly. "Nah," she answered sternly. "He ain't no sneak." The father turned to Fred Mims, one of the survivors, and asked him where John was and how had the bridge been destroyed. "You see," said Mims, "when that terrible wind come up, we was out about the middle of the river. Some of us was on the bridge, some on the deck. The wind blows so hard we could scarcely stand up. Mr. Hill told us to set down for a spell. He's afraid some of us might go overboard. Then all of a sudden the lights went out. Guess the wires was blowed down. We was all scared to move for slipping overboard. Then that rain commenced, and I never seen such a downpour since the flood. We sat there and someone began to pray. Lord, how we did pray to be spared. Then somebody raised a song, and we sung, you hear me? We sung from the bottom of my heart till daybreak, and when the first light come, we couldn't see nothing but fog everywhere. Couldn't tell which was water and which was land. But when the sun come up, the fog began to lift and we could see the water. And that fog was so thick and so heavy that it was hugging that river like a winding sheet. And when it rose, we saw that the river had rose way up during the rain. My God, Alf, it was running high. So high it nearly touched the bridge and red as blood. So much as clay, you know, from land down she done overflowed. Coming downstream as fast as pressed train was 3 big pine trees. First one wasn't 40 feet from us, and there wasn't no chance to do nothing but pray. First one struck us and shocked the whole work. Before we could stop shaking, the other 2 hit us, and down we went. I thought I'd never see home again. But, Mims, where's John? I ain't seen him, Al, since the log struck us. Maybe he swam ashore. Maybe they picked him up. What's that floating way out there in the water? Alfred shaded his eyes with his guarded brown hand and gazed out into the stream. Sure enough, a man was floating on a piece of timber. He lay prone upon his back. His arms were outstretched. The water washed over his brogans.
but his feet were lifted out of the water whenever the timber was buoyed up by the stream. His blue overalls were nearly torn from his body. And this story is nearly over. But I don't think I'm